Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Freedom Shield, The 191st Assault Helicopter Company in Vietnam, by Major John D. Falcon, retired, narrated by Sean Compton. Every person who fought for this nation has a story. All are important in their own realm. All should be told in their own light, and that gem hidden within can only be found by the true seeker. James Fisher, Kingsville, Texas. Foreword. Film footage of the Vietnam War almost always depicts iconic scenes of UH-1 Huey helicopters as they slick in American troops to hot landing zones under heavy enemy fire. The 191st Assault Helicopter Company, AHC, the Boomerangs, knew the routine well. It led all other assault helicopter companies in the 12th Combat Aviation Group in total combat flying in 1968. Each 191st chopper came with a bright orange boomerang painted on its nose section to illustrate its motto, "Boomerangs always come back." Tragically, not always. Reminiscent of the author Ernest Hemingway, Major John D. Falcon, retired, delves deep into what is true about war and the human condition in his raw and gritty history of helicopter warfare at the height of the Vietnam conflict. Only a Vietnam vet and former member of the 191st could accurately recreate the sights and sounds of the Vietnam battlefields, or show us the fear and horror in witnessing close friends torn to pieces. Major Falcon gives the listener just that. Even though America has been almost continuously at war since 1918, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the War on Terror, only a minute percentage of its citizens have actually served in the military and gone to war. The collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11, repeated attacks on the U.S. and other Western nations, the ghastly spectacle of terrorist beheadings and massacres of Christians, and the nearly 20 years of American troops fighting terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan have made remarkably little impact on the lives of most Americans. Other than for those who have lost loved ones to hostile action, we have a tendency to forget the past and move on. The War on Terror will be known as America's longest war. World War I and World War II were wars to end all wars. Korea was the forgotten war. Vietnam was the war of the forgotten soldier. Those who fought in Vietnam and were regarded by protesters at home as baby killers slipped back in country afterward as though they should be ashamed. Many, if not most, locked their pain inside and have only reluctantly talked about their experiences, except to other veterans. We tried to tell you about this pain 40 years ago, a generation of Vietnam vets say, but no one wanted to listen. Major Falcon penetrates the protective wall that surrounds many Vietnam veterans, a wall that in the past prevented them from telling their stories, in their personal perspective, about soldiers and airmen in combat who lived with violence and death. The grisly scenes he describes are accurate, raw, and unembellished. Helicopter crews like sitting ducks on LZs under fire. Medevacs risking their own lives to rescue the wounded. Infantry soldiers landing into hell against an entrenched enemy. Gunships providing cover fire against machine guns, RPGs, and anti-aircraft fire. All seen through the eyes of grunts in the air and on the ground. At the same time, he provides comprehensive insight through a range of action that shows the Assault Helicopter Company as a cohesive unit composed of many different individuals and positions, all working together toward a common goal and mission. Large-scale air mobile operations brought the different factions together into a functioning force. Slick pilots, gunship pilots, door gunners, crew chiefs, Air Force fast movers, artillery, infantry, command and control, company commanders, battalion commanders, all saw the same events unfold, but from different positions and perspectives. The Freedom Shield's descriptive power moves from the intensely personal voice of an infantryman leaping out of a hovering Huey under fire to see his best buddy cut down, to the big picture of commanders controlling the action from the sky, or commanders at corps and theater level moving colored pins on a map. No two levels shared the same threat level or viewpoint, but each of the warriors telling his part of the story contribute to the rich tapestry of what it actually is like to face death in mortal combat. The numerous veterans who contributed to this work feel obligated to speak for those who died gallantly as members of the 191st AHC, and to tell those stories that might otherwise have vanished into history and time. The names of those who gave their all appear here in honor of their service and sacrifice. The families of these men suffered, perhaps, the greatest loss of all. Charles W. Sasser, Army Special Forces, retired, author of One Shot, One Kill, Hill 488, Night Fighter, The Walking Dead, A Marine's Story of Vietnam, and other works about the Vietnam War. Chapter 1. Ben Tray, A Bloody Fight. But this was Vietnam. Life here perched on the unpredictable, always about to take a turn. In war, life has a way of turning on a dime. It is often a small choice that determines who lives and who sacrifices their young lives. The Vietnam War was no different than any other bloody war. However, for the young guys who lived it, breathed its vigorous stench of rot and mud, the Vietnam War was like no other. In retrospect, life was simple here. Turn left, you live. Turn right, you die. The Boomerang, Bounty Hunter, and Green Delta crews of the 191st Assault Helicopter Company, AHC, had their share of both choices. Either way, these choices left lasting wounds. By late morning on September 30th, 1968, the combat operation of the 191st AHC forged ahead like any other day. The quiet Specialist 4, SP4, Glenn Lawfield, a striking youngster with clean-cut looks, always available with a pleasant demeanor and a warm smile, reported that morning as gunner for Boomerang 1-3, a lift ship that was a Huey configured for troop transport, or a SLIC for short. "I'm Boomerang 1-3 Golf, correct, sir?" Lawfield asked Warrant Officer 1, WO1, Dave Perez, his aircraft commander, AC. SP4 Andy Johnson came up from behind and smacked Lawfield on the back. "If he still remembers what to do." Although Perez, Lawfield, and Johnson were Boomerang 1-3's regular assigned crew, Lawfield hadn't flown in weeks. On this day, he volunteered to substitute for someone else. The crew was together again, and Johnson and Lawfield were happy for it. Lawfield cocked his head and flashed Johnson that pleasant smile. Lawfield hailed from near Detroit, Michigan, and bunked next to his buddy Johnson. The two were barely out of high school and acted like high school buddies, inseparable and always joking around. While Lawfield and Johnson prepared for their morning's mission, they chatted about home and what they would do when they returned to the States. They both had made a pact to visit each other once they were safely back on friendly soil. "Hey, Johnson," Lawfield called to his best buddy. "When you come up to visit me in Detroit, I'll introduce you to the finest women in America. That is, if you still remember what to do." They both laughed. Lawfield mounted the aircraft's M60 machine guns on their pentals. He swung each to its fore and aft limit, ensuring that if needed, they could traverse their full range of motion. It would be unforgiving if a weapon hung up at the wrong moment. The thought of surviving this day hung foremost in Lawfield's mind, as it did in the minds of each crew member. With mission preparations completed, Boomerang 1-3's morning unfolded in an uneventful routine as the entire Boomerang flight took to the air. The last wisps of fog drifted up from the jungle and evaporated as the morning sun heated the vast network of rice paddies. From above, the scene appeared tranquil. For a brief moment, its beauty could hold a man in its sway like a seductive woman. Nevertheless, behind the veil, deep in the dense green palms, tall green grasses, and underground mazes of intricate tunnels, lurked the enemy, trained and ready to kill. The American air crews remained on edge. With the cooler monsoon season now gone, humidity and tropical heat aggravated combat tensions. The pungent smell of mold and the sickening, almost flowery aroma of decaying mud filled the crew's nostrils and permanently embedded in their gear. Helmet headbands, soaked with sweat, compressed their weight on aircrew skulls. Neck agony grew by the hour. Tolerable, Crew Chief Johnson thought, in comparison to battle stress. Lawfield pulled his helmet off and wiped sweat from his brow. Anticipating enemy gunfire from the tree line below, he cleared the moisture from his eyes to best view the field. He was well aware that mere seconds could make a life-or-death difference. If fired upon, Lawfield had to volley back without delay. The anxiety racked the nerves of everyone on board. With a nimble finger posed on the trigger of an M60 machine gun, Lawfield remained focused on the jungle below. His heart pounded while the slick ascended out of the landing zone, LZ, and climbed to a safe altitude. All guns on the assault aircrafts remained silent, and their crews happy for it. Chief Warrant Officer 2, CW2, Bill Janes, and CW2 Larry D. Miller flew the lead boomerang ship. Janes took note of the enemy's absence. All was quiet so far. This just might prove to be a good day, he thought. Nonetheless, every troop insertion and extraction proved to be a nail-biter. The flight descended through 500 feet above ground level, AGL, to drop off troops into the LZ. Intercoms fell silent. Stomachs tightened and hearts shuddered as the crew braced for the gut-wrenching explosion of "Receiving fire! Receiving fire!" followed by the airframe tremor from M60 machine guns spitting out 7.62-millimeter bullets, 350 rounds per minute. But for now, the flight descended in peace. Nestled in an ancient agrarian culture, the jungles, rivers, and rice paddies below seemed to move at a pastoral pace. But this was Vietnam. Life here perched on the unpredictable, always about to take a turn. While on short final approach to insertion 4, the 191st AHC flight was pommeled from cockpit to tail fin. The rapid smack and ping of metal on metal echoed through their fuselages. The North Vietnamese Army, NVA elements, had anticipated the American attack and had prepared well, hiding in concealed enemy emplacements. The 191st birds were restricted from returning door gunfire for fear of hitting Americans nearest the enemy. Flying the Chalk 3 bird, Captain Ray Big Swede Rug, Boomerang 1-6, watched sparks leap off the skins of the first two aircraft as enemy tracers ripped through them. The radios were jammed with pilots alerting lead of warning lights flashing impending engine failure, leaving the 191st AHC tactical frequency nearly unusable. The enemy knew they had the flight in a vulnerable position. The tall trees in front of the formation required a slow ascent out of that hellhole, giving the enemy ample time to inflict maximum battle damage. Most alarming to Rug, during the slow climb out, the tail boom of the Chalk 2 bird jerked back and forth, an indication of severe pilot stress. Perez, its AC, was a seasoned combat assault pilot, but Rug suspected the worst. Someone on the crew had been hit. Feeling the heavy dose of enemy bullets slam into his aircraft, Perez carefully monitored the engine instruments. Uncertain if its power could complete the perilously slow ascent, The skillful AC lightly held the controls, demanding no more than minimum stress on the wounded bird. Years later, the experienced Perez recalls that day's climb out from the enemy-infested LZ. I knew I had to remain cool. If I got hit, my co-pilot, barely a week in-country, might have to fly the bird out. With full throttle and a windshield of blue sky, the bird reached only 50 feet AGL when a North Vietnamese soldier stepped out from the lush green coconut palms, aimed his AK-47 at the bird's nose, and cut loose. At that very instant, Perez recalls, it seemed like the heart-throbbing pause in a nightmare, a time warp when escape seems futile. The world's big motion picture paused in the middle of a live streaming, a common sensation in battle. Time seems to stand still except for the pinpoint moment of what's coming at you inch by inch, in slow motion, sometimes with no hope of deflecting it, dodging it, or changing the impending outcome. I saw the fire from the muzzle of the enemy weapon, Perez continues, and saw the plexiglass shatter in small pieces as the bullets ripped through the aircraft chin bubble, smacking my right boot off the foot pedal. Without even thinking, I placed it back to maintain directional control as we continued the climb out. As calmly as I could, I told my brand new Peter pilot, "We're still receiving fire, but keep your cool. We'll be out of here in a minute." Perez was hit in the foot, but hoped it wasn't anything serious. "Just keep your hands near the controls in the event you need to fly the bird out of here," he said to his frightened co-pilot. His Peter pilot, like all greenhorns, experiencing the pit of hell up close and personal, was spooked. "I wanted him close to the controls in case I took another more serious hit," Perez recalls. Not wanting to add to the lad's already overladen fears, Perez kept his cool. Perez cleared the trees and leveled off. He glanced down at the large hole in his boot. The bullet tore out a hunk of his right foot on the outer edge, close to the heel, and peeled back the boot's leather. At about this moment, things seemed to happen in rapid sequence for Perez. Wind from the open cargo bay rushed through the bird's interior. Specks of blood and small pieces of human tissue gathered in rapid succession across the cockpit windshield. "I knew it was not my blood," Perez recalls. "And almost as soon as I saw it, Johnson keyed the intercom and announced that Lawfield was hit. Since I was still flying the aircraft, I told my co-pilot to climb over the console and help Johnson provide first aid to Lawfield. I was feeling pain, but not enough to prevent me from flying the bird." The Huey had received a beating. The engine oil pressure dropped. The tension in the flight controls softened, growing sluggish and less responsive. Perez had to set it down soon. He called Janes and Miller in lead to report his battle damage and wounded crew. "Lead, this is 1-3. I just took several hits and have wounded on board. Request permission to break formation and return to the PZ, pickup zone, to await medevac." "Roger, 1-3, Janes in the lead bird responded. Janes immediately contacted the first platoon leader, Captain Rugg. 1-6, this is lead. Did you copy that?" "Lead, 1-6, I copy." 1-6, lead. "Break formation and take care of 1-3 while we resolve our battle damage. We have a serious fuel problem." Lead's voice rang loud with concern. Rugg knew, however, that he also needed to check his own bird for battle damage, lest he risk adding to the emergency at hand. Without a second thought, he broke formation and headed to Ben Tre Airfield. Rushing wind noise from faster-than-normal airspeed alerted Rugg's crew that speed was key to their rescue mission. Lives were at stake. With seatbelts fully tightened and headgear firmly snugged down, the aircrew sat with their stomachs tensed while the slick traveled at its maximum speed, 120 knots, a speed that, given the slick's unknown battle damage, could rip it apart. Some crew members prayed in silence. Meanwhile, Perez's bullet-riddled helicopter lumbered toward the previous PZ. The young gunner Lawfield gushed blood from a deep shrapnel wound on his upper cheek. Penetrating deep into his skull, the fiery piece of steel accomplished the enemy's intent. It delivered a death knell and left the crew helpless to save their crewmate. The heart-wrenched crew chief and newbie pilot held down their stomach contents and worked through the metallic stench of human blood to comfort the wounded youth. "Glenn, can you hear me?" Johnson asked Lawfield. Consciousness slowly slipped away from his bunkmate and good buddy, and Johnson's voice trembled. "Glenn, talk to me, buddy." But Lawfield did not respond, and Johnson grew more hysterical. "I want to hear you say something. Glenn, talk to me, brother." Struggle as he did to stay alive, Lawfield's final gasps fell silent in minutes. His body relaxed, releasing all its earthly fluids, and lay quiet. Johnson wept, and the immense battle raged unfettered. With nerves strained to their limits and emotions running rampant, Perez fought off the discomfort of his wounded foot that radiated pain up his leg. Lawfield's death had rattled Perez's mental composure, but getting the battle-damaged aircraft back to a friendly PZ was critical. Instruments, including the engine oil gauge, warned of looming engine failure. "Fighting to keep my foot on the rudder pedal, I searched for a landing spot," Perez recalls. "The sloppy flight controls hammered my brain with the reality that landing the bird in enemy-held territory was death-defying, yet imminent." Making his final mayday call, Perez had stressed the urgency to Rugg, his platoon leader. "Boomerang 1-6, this is Boomerang 1-3. 1-6, go ahead. 1-6, this is 1-3. I'm approximately 2 clicks west of the last PZ with wounded on board. I'm gonna try to make the PZ, but need medevac soonest." "Roger 1-3, I'm en route and have visual contact with your bird. Be there in 6 or 7 mics. In battle, every second can alter fate. Nevertheless, Rugg had no choice but to land and check his bird for battle damage. In less than 3 minutes, the platoon leader was back in the pilot seat. He restarted the engine with an abbreviated fast start and lifted the slick into the thin air. He scanned the horizon to his south and caught a glimpse of Perez's damaged slick in the distance. Pulling max power, Rugg followed the flight path of the battle-torn Huey until he landed within 20 meters. He thanked God the 1-3 aircraft and crew made it back to the friendly PZ. Janes and his flight lead bird and crew were already there, shut down and with no visible burn damage, the crew safe. Maybe a good omen. But Rugg's mind darkened when he drew close to the heartbreaking sight of Perez's bird. Human tissue, plastered on the bullet-riddled windshield and brilliant red under the Asian sun, alerted Rugg of the gravity of the situation. The concerned platoon leader knew all too well what awaited. With the cargo door open, the foul smell of a life just expired, the blood and human fluids, like a rotted tooth extraction but worse, percolated through the air. Rugg stuck his head through the cargo hatch. Blood pooled wide under Lawfield's body, and Rugg's eyes sank deep into their sockets. He had looked at the young Lawfield as if he were his little brother. Rugg's lips pulled tight into a downward turn, and he reached for the boy's body. A glimmer of hope took hold, and he hauled the youngster from Perez's aircraft. The crew helped him load Lawfield onto his bird for a rapid flight to Dong Tam Hospital. But it was too late. On September 30th, 1968, SP-4 Glenn Lawfield breathed his last breath aboard Perez's ship before it even touched down in the friendly PZ. Johnson and Perez spent some time on the hospital pad trying to cope with this reality. Perez's wound required minor medical treatment, and he was awarded a Purple Heart. Lawfield earned a Purple Heart, too, posthumously. Nevertheless, the disparity of sacrifice was immense. Lawfield's hospital run had done little to soften the blow for his fellow aircraft crew members. When a warrior with mortal wounds struggles to remain alive, images of his closing moments are permanently etched into the memories of those who witnessed his last breath and final heartbeat. It is those images that years later spring back to life on the living faces of the dead. They form a permanent mental scar. Ben Tray was a hellhole that both Ruggs and Perez's crews would never forget. The death of Lawfield worked on the minds of all of us, Perez recalled. But I think Rugg took it worst of all. Battle stress was clearly carved into his face. Decades later, the wounds of that day are still fresh. He was just a kid, for Christ's sakes, Rugg explains. The most wholesome and decent kid you could ever meet. You would think that after seeing so many people die, it would get easier to let go. But it doesn't work that way. It burns a hole in you every time you see one of your crew members get killed. Rugg's facial expressions assume the same posture witnessed by his crew on that fateful day. As the breeze blew through the locks of his hair, you would think he was sleeping, Rugg explains. But in reality, his youthful expression just reached into your heart and tore at the very fabric that bonded us together. The day Lawfield was killed, Rugg had been close to his date of rotation back to the U.S. and would soon be free from combat stress. He took little comfort, however, in this fact. His deep sense of loyalty to all those who served him intensified his deep pain. The loss of human life gripped him, leaving a lasting impression. Rugg saw his share of battle death. One might expect that by then he would have grown calloused and accepted the consequences of war that were beyond his control. But even though decades have elapsed since this experience, his pent-up anger and pain are still evident when he recalls the young Lawfield's death. When I saw him lying there on the floor of that Huey, lifeless, it really tore into my soul. 18 years old, fighting in a stupid, damned war that nobody back home seemed to want, and now he was dead. Rugg's face collapses into a grimace like you might see on a person who just lost a family member. To make matters worse, Rugg continues, people in California spat at U.S. soldiers returning from Vietnam. Of those who knew him and were close to him, all would tell you that Glenn Lawfield was one of the finest youngsters our country had in uniform. Every loss has dug long roots into Rugg's memory, as well as every place where fatalities occurred. Embedded in the minds of all warriors who survived the horrors of Vietnam are the names of places where their comrades bled and died. Van Tuong, Ya Drang, Khe San, Ben Tray. Among those who fought, the very name of the battle site yields a certain reverence for the kindred souls whose lives ended in the rice paddies, thick jungles, and battle-torn assault helicopters of Vietnam. Among the numerous battle sites where the 191st pilots, crew members, and support personnel died in action, this is how the survivors remember Ben Tray. As capital of Kien Hoa Province in the military 4th Corps region of South Vietnam, Ben Tray is remotely situated along a narrow canal that connects two major distributaries of the Mekong River. Located 20 miles northwest from the South China Sea, the community draws its subsistence from the waterway, which provides a fishery refreshed twice daily by the tide, and also serves as a transportation route for the substantial Sampan River traffic. Because the enemy operated beneath the jungle canopy with substantial impunity and easily imported war material along the river in sampans, Ben Tray was an ideal location for an enemy stronghold. However, the town itself and its small airstrip were generally secure.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?